First, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
During a visit by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, Nigeria's military announced that Boko Haram's vicious leader, Abubakar Shekau, had been killed in an airstrike in northeast Nigeria. This is not the first time that Shekau was reported killed by the Nigerian government, but comes at a critical time for President Buhari. For months, the Nigerian regime has requested that the Obama administration provide more military aid, including the sale of a dozen A-29 Super Tucano attack aircraft. Boko Haram is now an affiliate of ISIS. The terrorist group came to the world's attention in 2014 after they kidnapped 280 schoolgirls in the village of Chibok. Over 200 of the girls are still missing. Over the last decade, 20,000 people have died in clashes with Boko Haram fighters. Today, Bama, the largest city that Boko Haram had held near the Cameroon border, is in shambles. The Nigerian army took control in March as thousands of people fled and widespread hunger and malnutrition set in. Even before the Nigerian airstrike targeting Abubakar Shekau, his status as Boko Haram's leader was in doubt. A new leader, Abu Masab al-Barnawi, the son of the founder of Boko Haram, emerged to challenge Shekau's position, declaring that attacks on mosques must stop, an initiative supported by ISIS's Salafist leadership. According to Foreign Policy magazine, indigenous women in Canada are four times more likely to be murdered than white women. Official statistics reveal that over 1,200 Native women were killed or have gone missing since the 1980s. This disturbing information comes at a time when Canada is dealing with its long legacy of racism against Native peoples. A shameful chapter in the nation's history includes the forced relocation of over 150,000 Native children who were sent to so-called resident schools, where they were compelled to assimilate into white culture. The hostile attitudes toward Native peoples run deep in Canadian law enforcement, who have often blamed cases of missing or slain Indigenous women on drug overdoses, suicide, or runaways. In 2013, an academic paper identified 824 cases of slain or missing Indigenous women. The research prompted an official investigation by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who investigated nearly 1,200 cases of violence against Native women between 1980 and 2012. Cameron Alexis of the Assembly of First Nations called the findings a national shame and a national tragedy. When Canadians overwhelmingly elected Justin Trudeau as Prime Minister last October, one of his first acts was to announce a national inquiry into Indigenous murders. "The victims deserve justice," he told a gathering of First Nation chiefs in Gatineau, Quebec. "Their families deserve an opportunity to heal and to be heard." Young Chicago activists known as Future Fighters are visible at rallies organized by the Fight for 15 movement and Black Lives Matter. Future Fighters was launched by young members of the Service Employees International Union in Illinois and Indiana. These union activists are committed to exposing and combating income inequality, police brutality, and homelessness. Future Fighters founder Lakeisha Collins, a nursing home worker, approached an SEIU official seeking support for a new group of union members under age 35. After Michael Brown and Trayvon Martin were murdered, Collins told the publication Labor Notes, "We wanted to do more than protest in the streets, so we came up with Know Your Rights trainings." The first training attracted 70 union members, and workshops were held every few months on topics such as rights of protesters, race and class stereotyping, and the role of labor in the U.S. civil rights movement. Chandra Robinson, a co-founder of Future Fighters, recalled that discussions focused on how to de-escalate dangerous situations with law enforcement and on the long history of the judicial system working against the interests of minority groups. The movement later broadened to involve activists affiliated with Black Lives Matter in confronting police brutality. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
After a series of terrorist bomb attacks targeting police and civilians inside Turkey and a failed coup attempt against his government, Turkey's president, Tayyip Erdogan, ordered his nation's military to invade northern Syria with the stated goal of guaranteeing his citizens' security at home and in neighboring countries. The offensive, which began on August 24th, saw Turkish tanks, artillery, and Syrian rebel allies, backed by air power, quickly capture the Syrian border town of Jarablus from Islamic State militants. But since that initial assault, Turkish forces have moved into areas controlled by fighters allied with the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, a coalition that includes the Kurdish YPG militia that has won praise from the Obama administration for its effectiveness in battling ISIS. Clashes between Turkish-backed forces and the YPG have killed at least 25 Kurdish fighters, amid accusations that Turkey has targeted Kurdish civilians in airstrikes, a charge that Ankara denies. Washington has criticized Turkey's attack on the Kurds and is working to stop the fighting between its two allies. While Turkey favors the overthrow of the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad and opposes ISIS, President Erdogan's priority is widely believed to be preventing the establishment of a Kurdish enclave either in Syria or inside Turkey. Your reporter spoke with Michael Beer, director of the group Nonviolence International, who talks about the escalation of violence in Syria after the Turkish invasion and prospects for success in U.S.-Russian ceasefire talks taking place in Geneva.
The Turkish president, Erdogan, has been quite clear about his goals, if we can believe him, which I think we can. And his stated goals are that he wants to go after the ISIL, or sometimes called ISIS or Daesh group, which is the Islamic State. And he also wants to prevent the Kurds from capturing the entire Turkish-Syrian border area. And these are his two stated goals. He may have others that we don't know. But he's been attacking both ISIL groups as well as Kurdish Syria Defense Force groups. And this is an escalation of the war. Turkey, of course, has been deeply involved in providing all kinds of weaponry and political support to various actors fighting against Assad, and has shelled the border areas for a variety of reasons, usually shelling the Kurds. And this is an escalation where they've actually sent in tanks, and we don't know how long they're going to be there. President Erdogan has said in the last few days that he is there until ISIL and the Kurds are destroyed. Well, I mean, he's going to be there 1,000 years if he thinks he's going to be destroying the Kurds. So we're just not sure where this is going, other than to say that Syria now has been intervened by many, many foreign actors. And of course, the wars, there's more than one, are going to get worse as long as we have lots of outside actors who are pouring fuel on the fire.
Michael, also in the news recently has been the Russian bombing campaign in alliance with the Assad government to try to end the stalemate in one of Syria's largest cities, Aleppo, with tragic consequences. Just thousands of civilians have been killed, and that's a huge city with a civilian population now, shortage of food and medicine. Hospitals have been bombed. Russia had been using, I guess, for a short while, air bases in Iran, and then were kicked out. Lots to talk about there, but maybe we could focus on the human tragedy that has been unfolding for a long time now in Aleppo.
I thank you for focusing attention with your question about the human suffering in Syria. It's easy to get lost in this very complicated political war game of various factions and who the various external actors are, and lose sight of the fact that Syria is being ripped apart, and that people are being, and civilians are being killed on an enormous scale and are suffering so much. We are seeing in Aleppo an attempt by the Russians and the Assad regime and the Iranians to try to militarily win back, as they say, Aleppo, and the suffering is tremendous. They're bombing hospitals. They're bombing schools. They're starving out areas. All sides are trying to starve out areas of the other. As long as we have a lot of external actors, or even internal actors, that think that they can win this conflict militarily, this is unfortunately going to continue. We desperately need to have peace talks to end this fighting, because there really is no military solution or victory. It may be that the Russians and the Assad regime think that they can get Aleppo back by bombing it to smithereens, and the suffering is just unbelievable. But even if they get Aleppo back, much of the country, big chunks of the country, are not under the control of the Assad regime and are not likely to be. And there's just desperately needs to be talking. And unfortunately, the U.S. is the lead country, the leading country in the world in terms of military power, economic power, political power. We're not really in the place to be leading talks because, frankly, we won't talk to everybody. The United States will not talk to some of the major external actors like Hezbollah. We won't talk to ISIL. We need to talk to everybody, because there is no military solution. In order for this to come to conclusion, we have to get all the stakeholders at the table. Unfortunately, the U.S. is taking sides, and so we're not in the place where we can be a peacemaker, and we're helping pour a lot of fuel on this fire, unfortunately.
What are the prospects, if any, that there could be a breakthrough between Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov in talks in Geneva to arrive at some formula for a ceasefire so the killing will stop?
Well, there have been some suggestions this week that they're just not able to reach an agreement. And we're going to need sustained pressure from citizens around the world. Unfortunately, there's not much of a movement in the United States yet around this, but I think, and I'm hoping it's growing, to pressure the United States to move towards a ceasefire and a political solution in a more serious way. At the moment, I'm pessimistic that there don't seem to be on the horizon the kind of pressures that we need to get to pressure the United States and Russia to try to help make a deal as two of the leading players here.
That was Michael Beer, director of the group Nonviolence International. Learn more about the many nations supporting proxy forces engaged in Syria's civil war and prospects for peace by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Okay, remember. Okay, remember that we have just allowed half an hour to get into it and get out the sense of adventure.
This KBOO program is made possible in part from Wilkin & Company, PC Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com, and by Grindle's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grindle's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grindle's Coffee House. And thank you for your generous support, individuals and members of KBOO.
Que se faça, deixa a praia, deixa.
And this program is made also possible in part by Seattle Theater Group, presenting astrophysicist Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, September 19th and 20th at the Keller Auditorium. Dr. Tyson will explore science as portrayed in pop culture, and tickets and information for his September 20th show are available at portland5.com. Up next is Locus Focus, up next.